Parshas Mishpatim. We'll see what happens. Parshas Mishpatim. We get a parakof al pasuk beis. Here's what it says: Ki sikne evidi brishishan miyavod bashviz yot ite lachoshes inyam. So 6 years he got to work. 7th year he goes free, right, and no problem whatsoever. This is referring to the evidi bri. This is what happens when you buy an evidi bri, a Jewish slave. Now, it seems strange that out of any law that you could come up with, this is the first one that Bnei Zohar taught. Eila mishpatim asher tassim levim. These are the mishpatim. Start off with buying an evid ivri. Now, you'd assume, especially these laws are connected to Har Sinai, that these laws would have a certain order, or that there would be something there. It seems like it's such a mishmash, and especially this. A Jewish slave is what you're going to start off with? Why in the world would that be so important that you'd have to go into this? Plus, wouldn't you need to know a ton of other halachos before you get to this point? Well, I mean, first you have to know why he's an Eved Ivri. What, just a random guy who just becomes an Eved Ivri? Here's what you got to do. This is what you have to have over here. It seems so strange that this is the first mitzvah. So Ramban says, we're connecting this first mitzvah to the first mitzvah of the Aseret HaDibros. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeicham eretz Mitzrayim. I am Hashem your God that took you out of Egypt. It reminds us that just like in Egypt we were slaves, right? And so too, God who created Maaseh Bereishis, He took us out of Egypt and He created the world. So too, this is what we have over here with the Eved Ivri. We have a slave who goes free in the 7th year to show like some type of remez to Maaseh Bereishis. Due to these hints and others, this mitzvah is a worthy mitzvah to start off. So it's not because of the subject matter, says the Ramban, that it's so important that we started off with. It's not because of the subject matter. The subject matter really doesn't matter. The real reason why we started off the whole mishpatim with this is because of the remez, the hint. We were once abadim, God freed us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in 7 days. And for those hints, that's why we're starting off with this over here. Now the Kliyakar says, he wanted to stress the freedom aspect. The point is that our lives are not about just having as many slaves as we want to do all of our will and our whim and whatever it is, but rather to take in people who need help, put them back on their feet when they're ready to re-enter society. That's what we're really supposed to do. After being released from the slavery that we had in Egypt, where we were tortured and thrown down and do all this crazy work and whatever it is, this is the message that rang true in all of their ears. That the first law that they're being learned, they're being taught, is don't do what they did to you. Don't do that. What's up?
If it was just about work and like it was just financially based, mm-hmm. I mean, they could have made golems and stuff at that point, right?
No, okay, no. No, be a realist. Just for one day. Come on, No. That's not the truth.
It's one of the purposes for the slave to be able to have a way to do tshuva.
Again, yeah, 100%. But we're looking at the aspect of, fine, I understand what the mitzvah is. Why are you listing this first? What's the important part of it, about it being mentioned first? For that, the Ramban says, we got a remez. For that, the Kliyakar says, this is something that was true to them. They understood this a lot better because of their situation that they were in.
It's not like they're really like taking the guy in, you know, nurturing him back. But like the guy was stealing, and he just couldn't pay it back.
Nonetheless, he is in charge. The master is in charge of taking care of his family, making sure that he's paid for, making sure that everything's going to work out well for him. You know, so he does
not
have
the deal.
No, it's not for the owner. The owner is not making money off this deal.
Why on earth would anybody buy a slave then?
Why would he? No. You do get to keep kids from that slave.
Yeah, but
so you do make money off that if you wanted to make money off it. Plus, you are, if you're doing out of chesed, right, there is a kindness in taking in such a guy and being able to put him back on his feet. So that would be the real thing, the altruism of trying to help out the person without, you know, getting really anything back.
What?
You do, by the way. He does act as a slave. He's your guy. We're forgetting that a little bit. You are.
That's a whole other issue to get. Yeah. Like, a slave.
He's a Jeeves. That's what we get. You get a Jeeves. You shouldn't be upset about a Jeeves. I would love to have a Jeeves around me at all times.
Tuxedo or not.
I mean, you can buy him one. No one's going to stop him. White gloves, I'm assuming. Either way, then it sees. Understood. But nonetheless, then it sees stress as a different aspect over here. We got a different aspect. And every Ivri has got to be treated differently than the Kanani. And that's we're trying to say over here. We have a job to do. Our job as Jews is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu with all of our might. Being a slave to someone else is not going to allow us to do what we're supposed to do. We have a job to do, and we can't do it when we're slaves to others. Therefore, we're told to keep our slaves for a short amount of time, treat them differently than how we would keep another Eved who doesn't have the responsibility. And therefore, we're starting off the Torah by saying, here is the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. And really, that's the difference. We have a job to do. And even when you're a slave, you still have responsibility abilities as a Jew to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore he must be treated differently. That's the idea. So again, to stress the difference between us and them. Maral Diskin says, based on Midrashim, that our galus and our eventual ge'ula is contingent on how we treat our slaves. It's sort of like a mida k'neged mida. If we treat our slaves well, meaning those who are under us, and we treat them in a very respectful way, and we allow them to be, then the other nations will treat us that way as well. That if we treat those who are beneath us, the ones that that need a little bit more kavod, if we do that, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will free us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take us out from bondage, and will allow us to have the gula in the proper time. Says the Maral Diskin, based on that medrash, that's the reason why it's first, to show us how to bring us back into the realm of gula. That's the idea behind it. That's four. Number five and number six both come from Rav Avigdor Miller. Number six really is similar to the Ramban up above, but Rav Avigdor Miller says number five, the compassion that we have to have for a low person or an oppressed person, it's a fundamental Torah attitude. It is a midah that we have to go over again and again and again. And it's one of the chief midos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That way of going down with the downtrodden, etc. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not with the game, those who are up above, but rather together with those who are down below, who, the ones who are machnia themselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We, therefore, we start off with this law to stress the importance of how to have compassion even for the lowly. Whether that's by buying him when he needs help and paying off his debts, taking care of his family, or treating him with respect by giving him one pillow in the house, you give the Evidy Bri the pillow. One bed in the house, you give Evidy Bri the bed. One steak in the house, you give the Evidy Bri the steak. That type of law and those types of laws show us the stress and how we're supposed to show other people the honor that they deserve.
Someone's willing to take him every year. I would assume he has more than one pillow in the house, more than one.
You have to assume, right? You're assuming that this guy is wealthy. Nonetheless, it could be that at this moment...
Why is he in the house?
No, but at this moment, he might be missing something. In other words, I normally have all the things that I could need, right? Because I'm able to buy this person. But there are times where I'm somewhere and I don't have enough to be able to afford it. Right? Yeah, whatever it is. You know, one bed on top of it, who gets that bed, right? Who gets it, or who gets the head of the bed, who gets the foot of the bed. There's something like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's that. Why is an Ivory? Anyway, so that's that. Number three, you don't have to. We're not going to make you. Number six. We did say that it's a memorial of us leaving Egypt. But nonetheless, the name of Eved Ivri comes from the fact that the Egyptians used to call us the Ivrim. We were never known as Bnei Yisrael back then. We were known as Ivrim, those from the other side of the Jordan River. It's funny, by the way. We call it Avranar, is the east side of the Jordan River, meaning Jordan. For them, they called Ivri the people on the west side of the Jordan River.
Yeah. From Aver. So the person who descended from Aver.
There is a 12-way machlokas that I have in my notes regarding where the word Ivri comes from. There's a famous Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, which is beautiful about it, about where it comes from. Yes, one of the answers is that it comes from Aver, right? Another answer is Aver Anar, but it's all out there, and it's almost all the Rishonim have an opinion on why they're called an Eved Ivri and not an Eved Yisrael. It is weird, because we never get called as Ivrim except around Egypt. Eved Ivri is strange. It does. It sounds good. Nonetheless...
And also, Yehudi would be Eved Yisrael. There's no Yehudi. I mean, everybody's a... I mean, Jews that were called Yisrael.
Well, yeah, it's an Eved of Yisrael. Meaning, it's a Yisrael... No, I shouldn't say an Eved of Yisrael. It's a Yisrael who happens to be an Eved. Right? That's what it would be. So, or Eved Yisraeli, maybe it would be called, or something like that. But that's that. Yeah.
From the Egyptian perspective, we're on the same side of the Arden as that.
But nonetheless, we were known as the Ivrim. Everybody on that side, because the main contingency were the people in bubble around that area. Anyone that was on the Canaanim and everybody like that were all known as Ivrim. If you notice, by the way, it does make it a little bit simpler. We thought it called Ivrim as simple. Canaan, Amori, Chiti, Chivi, Prizi, Vuzi, all those people were sons of Ham. They were all from the people of Ham who had taken over the land. Everybody who lived in Aram and Arabia and all those areas, they were all from Shem. They were grandchildren of Shem, meaning the Shem people, called the Semitic people, called the Ham kids, the Ivrim, those that were on the other side of the Jordan River. So even though that was a name, that was whatever, it was known as a derogatory name, and they kept calling the Jews.
But according to that, all the people of Sharam, they were all called Ivrim, along with the Jews, But of course, if you say that Ephraim is the descendants of Aver, all their cousins who lived in Aram, yeah, the Ephraim mean the people who are
in
the land of Canaan.
Correct. It would not be Aver, per se, the shame to Aver type of name. It would have to be from something else. Regardless, that's the idea behind it. And this, again, these laws, says Rabbi Victor Miller in his second answer, right, is to parallel the way that Hashem treated us when we were in Egypt. In other words, that's the idea. His compassion to us. Just like in Egypt, we left with a ton of money. We didn't go empty-handed. So too, when we leave the master, when the slave leaves the master, he does not leave empty-handed. That's the idea behind it, and that's what it's like to be under a human master. Yes, I'm sorry.
He leaves his kids.
No, he does not. Whoa, what? He leaves the kids that he has with the shifra. That's a different story altogether. A slave is not. A slave brings in his entire family, as well as his wife, his kids, and whatever. That's right. If he is already married, then he's allowed to be not married off, because there is no real marriage to a shifra. But he's allowed to be together with a shifcha, and the children from that relationship are kept by the master.
Shifcha Jewish?
There is no such thing as a shifcha that's Jewish over the age of 12. It has to be a shifcha kananis. The only amma ha'ivriya that we have is under the age of 12. Once they're 12, they automatically go free. Which means the shifcha kananis is allowed to be together with that eved ivri to have children that will be kept by the master, but they do not go free when the eved goes free. That's that.
In theory, you can't marry them. But she can't have a shiksa girlfriend.
Hey, she's not shiksa, she's chayv and mitzvos like a regular woman once she's a shifcha kananis. She has to go to the mikvah.
Like the best of them.
She's
to the mikvah.
Yeah.
But she's a goy.
No, she's not officially goy. She's a shifcha. Shifcha is a different status. She can't marry a regular Yisrael, but she is not a goy. If she would be freed, she's a Jew.
Well,
that's it. The shifcha kananis is different. No, not yet. I mean, she's a shifcha. That's the status.
So she's a non-Jew that's in between
the Canaanites.
She's not a non-Jew. She is a shifcha. That is not a status of a goy or a Jew.
Is she born from a Jewish
family? Listen. A shifcha kananis is a non-Jewish lady who is sold into slavery at any age. Okay. That shifcha kananis cannot marry a Jew, but she is chayiv in mitzvos, and you're chayiv to give her a tefillah when she first comes in to work for you. At that point, she can marry an eved ivri while she's a shifcha, right? She's allowed to marry an eved kanani while she's a shifcha. She can marry the eved kanani as well. She cannot be freed at all unless either you have somebody beats her up and she loses a limb of some sort, or if she's freed from her master, that her master says she's officially free, which is, he's over on an assay by doing so, but if he does free her, then she is a Jew completely. She cannot go back to her non-Jewish roots.
Well, she's a lot of Jews.
She is officially a Jew. She is officially a Jew.
Does she have to go through some sort of conversion?
No, she's done. She did her tefillah when she first came in. She's done with that.
Her rent of freedom, like when her husband...
So basically her status is not due to shifcha, and then automatically once she's released, she becomes a Jew.
A Jew. Just know, nobody released slaves. It was an assay to do so. So an Eved Kanani and a Shifcha Kananis were never freed unless there was extenuating circumstances. Eved Ivri, however, we know goes free at the end of 6 years. Right? Amal Ivriya goes automatically free when she turns 12. Right? But that's the only... No, not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be allowed, and you can get Malkus for being together with the Shifcha. Right? There is
that's
an ability... No,
Shifcha
Nechareshleish, there's Chiyuv Misa.
No, he gives a korban.
Chiyuv Misa by Shifcha Nechareshleish. She's considered a married woman if she's Nechareshleish.
And that's different than he's himself.
That's Ashem Vadai if it's an accident, if it's a kor, if it's a chatas. But if she's together with the person, if you're together with Shifcha Nechareshleish, that is a married woman, even though it's only a Shifcha, so to speak, nonetheless, you're Chiyuv Misa. That's that. Yeah.
There's no Kiddushin by Arafat.
There is such thing as Kiddushin, it's just not the same, because remember, they are quasi Jewish. They are somewhat Jewish.
No, I know that.
So there is a Kiddushin behind it. But not with an Eved Ivri. If she's Nechareshleish Eved Ivri, that might be different. What's up, Kanan? No, there is a way of selling yourself normally, even without Geneva. That's possible.
You're not based in.
I don't know. Only if they do sell themselves, isn't that a variety of people that have to do it?
Wait, hold on. I can't hear. I'm sorry. What?
Well, the part of people that do that, instead of buying it and using it,
The Eved Ivri?
Yeah.
There's no question. If anybody wants to pay back his loan, they're allowed to pay back his loan. Nonetheless, nobody wants to, this is what they do. That's the next process. So here we go. That was sort of Victor Miller, and that was the compassion involved. Now we're getting into the answers that I really wanted to get into. to. There's Rav Mashiloch, Rav Yashiv, and Rav Hirsch. Let's do the Mashiloch first. He says an amazing thing. This parsha represents the Olam HaTikun. In other words, the Jews are on the level where they had nothing, where everything was gone, and they really were you know, no mitzvos, no anything at all. That was the world of Adam HaRishon after the Chet. After the Chet had happened, bad things are going on. The world before mitzvot, that's what ends up happening. However, says the Mashiloch, there's an Olam HaTikun. The way of fixing up the world is through learning Torah, for doing Torah, for being Mekayim the Torah. That is the Olam HaTikun, and that started at Matan Torah. Adam HaRishon sinned, and from that point on, that caused a darkening of the world where bad things were happening, a destruction of Kedusha. By Matan Torah, or life was brought into the world. Mitzvos were brought into the world. There was a Kedusha that was allowed in the world itself. Thus, we start off the parsha with a tikkun of someone who stole. Why stealing? Adam HaRishon was chayiv for stealing the fruit off of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tree. That's the first thing that happened. Adam HaRishon stole from God, took from that tree, took the fruits off that tree, and our line is trying to fix up that thievery. So the first law we learn about is a guy who stole, got sold into slavery, and then ki sikne, lashon tikkun of an eved ivri. A tikkun of how we as avodim to HaKadosh Baruch Hu can fix up the sin of Adam HaRishon by doing mitzvos and learning Torah, and that way we can become a true eved of Hashem. That's the idea behind why we're starting off this parsha. Says Meshulah. What an unbelievable line! What do you got over there?
It's the Gemara in Chizkiyahu that says that Shifcha Harufa is amazing. Kizadon Elu Mivina Adon Kishogi Gabal Shifcha Menalan. Okay. Meaning he brings a korban that's shogeg or mezid, which seems to say that a Shifcha Harufa is
made without Edom. It's a pasuk. Well, okay, maybe I'm wrong about that. I'm 99% positive that it's a pasuk. Okay, but that's the Mashiloch. The Mashiloch brings that down. Number 8. In order to answer this question, Rabbi Yasha points out.
There's
a pasuk on Shechah Necharepes Leish. There's a pasuk on it. So yeah, so Rabbi Yasha points out the big differences between our method of judgment and the rest of the world. And it's a little bit scary to really think about it. See, the world prosecutes thieves when you just have one witness, or maybe circumstantial evidence, or it seems that he was a thief without actual proof. Well, we know that we need two Edim, and there has to be, well, that Geneva, you don't necessarily need Hasra, but two Edim or something like that. And we know that the reason why the world does that is because if you didn't have such laws, which sometimes make the innocent guilty, if you didn't go so chomer, well, Ish Yisrael Chaim Bla'o. In other words, anybody would go after their friend and take whatever they want, because they won't be caught. They're not going to be caught. We need some type of fear of anything. If they don't have that fear of heaven, at least a fear of judgment, so people should be afraid. They're not going to do this because there might be something. There might be a cop involved. Many people would speed more on the streets, but they're afraid there might be a cop that's hiding out in that area over there, right over there. You're scared of that. And we know that that fear of just a policeman, of just the people that are around, is something that can help us have something good happen. Our Torah tells us that a thief can only be found guilty with two witnesses. And if he can pay it back, what does he do? What happens if he can pay back the stuff that he stole? What happens?
He's let him free.
Well, what does he do? He has a chiyuv to pay it back.
Yeah.
Period. Does he get punished in any other way? Does he go to jail? Does he get sold as a slave? Nothing. Is that unbelievable? You stole. Sometimes, depending on the type of thievery, you might have to pay double. You might have to pay kapel. That's if you're a ganav, right? And you didn't admit to it. But if you're a ganav and you come into court and say, yeah, I stole, here's the stuff back, it's fine. It's fine. Not fine in Shemayim, but down here, you did your duty. That's it. There's nothing to really be scared of. Because all you have to do is make sure the other
thing is not fine in Shemayim.
In Shemayim, right, you still stole and you never did tshuva.
Really?
In Shemayim, just paying it back may take care of something, but you took somebody's object that was not yours and used it for a few days. To Hashem, maybe.
No.
That's what tshuva is.
No,
you did an avera of Geneva, and although you were able to fix up the lav, it's nitik la'aseh, so there's no korban or anything, that also means you get no kapara for the lav that you did. And until you fix it up, there's nothing to talk about. So you do. You need tshuva.
Tshuva. Like, how do you, like, the use, the guy had to come and report it.
Ramas. All grummas. All those are grummas, and in Shemayim you're held responsible for grummas.
You pay for that down here with money.
That's possibility, but tshuva is the only way to take care of things in Shemayim.
But
that's that.
A chov down here, then the person needs to pay the whole.
Correct. If there's a chov, an actual chov that somebody owes, right, that's going to be up there, yeah.
Isn't there a Gemara that talks about, like, I think the Gemara kind of talks about, like, the Sinek Makor stealing, like, a part of his roof, and you steal its metal and you return. And you have to pay.
So you're talking about in Merubah, the question of what you have to pay when you pay it back. Again, if you have the actual item and you're giving it back, there's nothing to worry about. If you used it, then there's a Shiloh that's Machlokas Tanoim, whether or not you have to pay back the actual object and knock down your house, or just pay the payment, the money thereof.
If you pay back double, you get out of that? I mean, if you pay back double,
no.
You are paying.
No, you so still somebody, stole.
So if somebody
you still stole. That's just
the house with it.
Then you have,
and a year later he gets caught.
According to one Tana, then you have to pay back the actual piece of metal, the actual piece, which means you have to knock down the house to be able to take that piece of metal back. According to the other Tana, no. Right? So when it comes to that, that is the machlokas. So that's the question. Our question for us is, listen, and granted, when a person gets, if a person doesn't have any money to pay it back, right, if there's no money to pay it back, he used up whatever it was and he has no money to pay it back. So what does he do? He gets sold as a slave. We all know that, right? He ends up getting sold as a slave. He gets sold as a slave. Now we know that the master is responsible to take care of his family, to make sure that things are paying for his needs, etc. Where's the deterrent? Where are people going to stop doing this? By the non-Jews, you have the possibility of a deterrent because they're going to make you responsible no matter what. But over here, where's the deterrent? Yeah, understood, but nonetheless, the worst thing that can happen to me is that I'll be sold as a slave and he'll take care of me for the next 6 years. That's the worst thing that can happen to me. Mostly in these cases, that. Why wouldn't anyone turn to thievery and take their chances? Just see what ends up happening. Deal with the possible and not so significant ramifications. Why wouldn't they do that? So Hashem tells us, do this parsha. And that's the idea of why we're starting this off. That my judgment system is totally different than a normal judgment system. It's based on emunah, and there's really nothing else. We have the right to punish, but we don't have the right to discourage others, to not allow those who need a kapara to get one. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of it. It's a crazy idea. Think about that for a second. We're telling somebody, you don't have to worry, that's going to be.
Society like that.
And it has been for years. It has been for years. That's the difference. The difference is,
I always had an impression that based in but punish people, just not the punishment that they got.
There is an allowance for Beis Din to do things when people take advantage of a system. That isn't there. That's Chosha Mishpat Simen Beis. Nonetheless, regardless, within the law system, if there's a Muna and a Kadosh Baruch Hu, then people understand this will all take care. Now, obviously, if people are taking advantage, you punish them. And you do whatever you can to be able to punish them. That's definitely within
the
system.
That makes sense for, like, religious laws, but civil laws, where there's a guy who's kind.
Again, there is such a thing as Beis Din taking into their own hands.
But it's always giving, like, everybody, like, a free ride. Then we only think I have to develop a pattern of this, then we'll take care of it.
But you know, right?
I understand that. But you want to have another guy.
Yeah, and that's the point.
But that's how we're grown. That's how we're bred.
I understand that.
But there's people where it becomes a public thing where you see the society following them and they think they're in democracy.
That's the obvious idea. And definitely, there's no question that the society is expected to be better on their own. If it doesn't happen, then we'll do something. We'll take care of it. But that's the moment where we'll have to say we don't want the deterrence that Kadosh Baruch Hu will take care of it on his own, so to speak. Capital H. That's the idea of where he's taking care of it. Now, Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is one of the craziest answers of all time. But this really goes into, like, a whole clause of the entire Torah. Now, listen to this answer, because this is literally one of the best answers I've ever heard. Rav Hirsch says, he starts this question, and he says, a whole new way of looking at the Torah, which is so obvious when you think about it, but it just took a genius to figure it out and just say it. And I think a person like Rav Hirsch to be able to say it. He starts by saying, the reason we start learning about Mishpatim, which concentrate on Benavim Lachavero, because before we go into the Mishkan, which is Benavim Lamakon, the reason why we go into these Mishpatim and then Truma Tetzaveh, the reason why we do that is because our relationship with God has to be built up through morality. And a true morality, interpersonal relationships, which allow us to work on ourselves and become worthy of serving God. If we can't deal with our fellow men, we don't deserve to be in a Mishkan or a Beis HaMikdash. That's the idea. We have to start off on ourselves, work on ourselves, what we're responsible to pay for, what we're not. work on Bava Kama, Bava Mitzvah, Bava Basra, and then, only then, can we graduate to the next level of trying to work and have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, from the outside perspective, if I was looking at the Torah, I would expect that the laws would be placed in a proper order, in a clear and concise way, right, that would be easy to understand and to carry out. It would be written, in my opinion, the way that I would have written up the Torah would be like a Shulchan Aruch. I would have written law by law, here's Orach Chaim, Yoredeach, Hoshem Mishpat, Evan Ezra. I would have written it out like that, and all you have to do is just eat. Just take from those laws, it would be right there. Mishpat would be written in such a way that it would have a system of laws that would go one after the other after any place in the world, like any constitution or anything else. They have the laws in such a way.
Mishpatim is kind of like
completely out of order. That's the problem. The problem is that this parsha contains naked sentences whose precise application, right, and to fully understand it, is left to Mesorah. The text tells us barely anything. You can't figure it out. By most of them, there's just a random most you must. Sometimes that's chenek, sometimes that's skiwa, sometimes that's trefa, sometimes that's herik. We have no idea what the pasuk is saying. You just have to figure it out from Mesorah, etc. But that's it. What are we supposed to do with that? We don't know how, we don't know what. Why would the Torah do such a thing? Ask Rapersh. It could be, it's got to be indicating that something's missing. It's indicating, there's clearly pointing that there's a Torah Sheba'al Peh that we're totally missing out on. Nothing shows the truth of this Torah Sheba'al Peh more than the first two laws that are the introduction to Parshas Mishpatim. The first two laws that are given over here, nothing could show us Torah Sheba'al Peh even more so. Moshe is now ready to delve into fundamental laws that would be able to be the ordinances, the basis of human society and justice that would govern man to his friend. And the first thing we talk about is when a man buys a Jewish slave, and then when a man sells his daughter. What in the world are you talking about? That is not the first law. It's the obvious ideas from the Aseret Dibros. Take it from there and go on from there. We're talking about murder. Let's talk about other things about murder, like hitting somebody. We're talking about stealing. Let's talk about stealing. We're talking about sleuthing. Let's talk about being together with people you shouldn't be together with. Arias. That's what you should start off with. You're starting off with this? What do these have to do with anything? So you have to understand. If the Torah is the absolute sole source of Jewish law, if there was no other way to learn Jewish law, it would be unthinkable to start with this. It would be ridiculous to start with these laws. We would need to know hundreds of rules before this. We'd need to know tons of things before this, before we go into these trivial, seemingly, and complex issues. Why would you do this? We don't even know how a person is made into an Eved Ivri. And you're starting with an Eved Ivri. It's a different matter, however, if the real source of Jewish law, of Jewish rights, is the Mesorah and not the Torah. If our real source of it is Torah Sheba'al Peh, and that it's going from mouth to mouth, from generation to generation, what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh, then we can understand that the Torah is no longer the repository of all the law. What is it? It's a memory aid. That's what the Torah is. The Torah is only used when doubts arise and you need a reference because you're not sure what the Mesorah is telling you because human error is commonplace. That's the only reason for the Torah. Not the source where we're getting everything from. The opposite. Our source is from Torah Sheba'al Peh, from Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth when he came down from Har Sinai. And the way for us to remember them and to understand them is from the Torah Sheba'al Peh, from the Torah that was written down. Now it seems scandalous to say such a thing, right? Because you say that and you're just like, that means that the Torah is the exact opposite way. But the truth is that this Sefer was only given to them after 40 years in the desert. Sefer Torah was not given to them on Har Sinai. They had certain things that were given to them on Har Sinai. But the Sefer Torah in of itself was written, it is. But nonetheless, the Sefer Torah with the laws that were written in was given to them at the end of 40 years in Parshas Vayelech when Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down the entire Torah. Meaning, up until that point, everything they needed to know, everything they studied, came from Torah Sheba'al Peh. It came from Moshe Rabbeinu bringing it down, explaining it to the judges going out to the people. They had a total of 78,600 judges that went out and explained what Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to tell everybody. And it's that. What's the Torah for?
One or two lawyers.
What? Yeah. It's only for the exceptional cases. That's what the Torah is. It's for the exceptional cases that are needed to be provided so you can understand normal things, normal principles of life that could be derived from the crazy cases. We are giving you crazy cases. The same way the Gemara, the Mishnayos, are sometimes giving you cases you'd never imagine would be there. Because if you know the crazy, then you understand simply tons of other cases that don't even need to be said. That's the concept. The Mishnah always mentions the most extreme case, and so too over here we're giving you concrete cases that will help you understand others. It's as if this is like a Mishnah, and the only reason why that works is because they knew, the people in the Midbar who received the Torah, knew that everything was preceded by Moshe Rabbeinu and what he said when he came down. Look in the Torah in that way, now you can look at it and you can understand. The language that's used was skillfully chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to allow a person who's looking for it to find an expression, right? An altered construction of a pasuk, a word, even a letter that the trained mind will look at and say there's something wrong here. Because it was written as a way of almost like a short note where you can see what it was supposed to get at. After all, it wasn't out of the Sefer Torah that the law was supposed to be acquired. It was only to be in the hands of those who were already well informed, and those people, this was just a way of retaining, reviving the knowledge that they already knew. That's the idea behind it. And that's what the Torah was really meant to be. Now, understand it. It's like short notes, says Rav Hirsch, for an extensive lecture from a professor. That's really what it would be. The whole Torah is short notes on a full and extensive lecture. Anyone who is there was present for the lecture can easily look at the short notes to help him understand what he might have heard and expand upon it. He'll be able to look back at it because he heard the original, and then he looks back and he's like, oh, now I got it, and that's that. For those who never heard the lecture before, the notes would be completely useless. You cannot figure out, you can't take and reconstruct entire lectures from the little psukim over here that are just the short notes. If you took short notes from a speech without ever hearing the speech and try to reconstruct what the guy was saying, you will never come out with what the guy was saying. You'll never come out with the same points. You'll never come out with what the guy really meant. You won't be able to do it. It's impossible.
There's no reference in this parsha or call to the lecture. Meaning, it doesn't say...
You don't know what the lecture was. They knew. They heard it. So they had the lecture.
It was indefinitely for all generations. So what could have said in the parsha, according to the word Moshe has spoken to you, or something to that...
That is. I don't understand. It didn't say that they were writing it down. It says that it doesn't say anything. Elam is Fatim Asher Tatim Lamayim. These are the Mishpatim that you'll put in front of them.
Right.
That's it. That's all it is. Meaning, you're going to expand upon it at first, and for 39 years, you're going to talk it over with them, and they're going to discuss it, have all the discussions, etc. And then at the end of those 40 years, that's when you're going to come along, and you're going to write this down. And all of this will be there, and it's going to be used as a short note, as an idea, for you to remember what the original idea was.
No, because my point is, if you're supposed to be learning out from this part that we're coming up with these crazy laws in the beginning, and from that we're supposed to learn out that there's this oral tradition.
No. Not crazy laws at the beginning. All the laws at the beginning. They learned everything. And at the end, they were given crazy laws, meaning the extremes, so that they could remember and understand the Stam laws that they had been learning for the past 39 years. The Torah is the one with the extreme. The Torah Shebaal Peh was every case that you can think of. The total of 301,000 letters is not going to be able to go through every case that you could possibly think of. But Torah Shebaal Peh, when a person is talking, he could give you every case.
No,
you just have to remember that.
Starts out with a Jewish slave and selling your dog.
I haven't gotten to that yet. All I'm saying is, this is the idea behind what the Torah is going through, and now we're going to get a little bit more.
So it was meant for those 78,000 teachers, I guess?
The Torah is meant for everyone. Everyone. Nobody yet. They weren't using it yet. It's used by the people, the initiated afterward. Meaning, all those that the initiated can produce from them, not of them, but from them, right? Uninitiated people will look at it and they'll look at that and they'll say, like, there's no way you could get that from the Torah. So you're going to look at that and say, come on, that's a witty play on words. You got a dream going on there, but that's not what it really says. You're right if you're just looking at the Torah and saying, this is what it's supposed to be. But it's the opposite. If you know that the true place of where all the laws are from Torah Shebaal Peh, meaning Misorah, and we get them all the way there, and this is only supposed to be the place where you find little hints to them, then the whole point of the Torah is just to be a hint book. There's supposed to be working through gematrias. And that's why everybody has these problems. They look at a gematria and they say, this makes no sense. I don't understand. Really? We're learning from this gematria? The only reason why you're saying that is because you're looking at it the opposite way. You're saying, here's where the full, where it should be written out. And you're like, why would it be a gematria? You should say it straight out. It's the opposite. Everything has to be through gematria and ramazim and abbreviations and rashi divs, dovi divs. Because you have billions of things that you're putting in one sentence. That's all you're doing.
Why have the laws and the Torah should all, Torah should have any, like,
why have them at all?
Yeah.
You have to have a reminder. You can't go without a reminder because people are going to forget. That's why we eventually wrote down parts of Torah Shmuel.
Every
you need it.
In the Torah has to have reference to the Torah.
There has to be a reference, correct. And that's the idea. Yeah, and that's the idea also. And plus, you've got to remember, there is an idea that a Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted to have something that would be solid and concrete for them to learn from. That was definitely true as well. It is unbelievable. But that's the reason why people have so many problems with all these gematrias and everything. It's not a problem. That's the whole idea of what it's supposed to be. So back to our original question. Now we're getting back to the original question. So why start this off? This Parsha's purpose is to tell us basic human rights. There is an idea of basic human rights that we have, which is something that now is such a highly debated subject. What is the basic human right of a human being? To that purpose, we start when we're going through our sort notes with the criminal. We're told how to punish such a person and what to do with them. The rehabilitation process of bringing them back to society. There is no better law for the purpose of rehabilitation because there is no other case where the Torah takes away freedom as a punishment. There's no other case like that. It's the only time you have it. It's the only time you have a lowly Jew, a person who is considered or put in a position where he is under another master. There's no such case, no other such case like this. The method of helping this guy come back is to bring him into a family, show him how to truly live life, allow his family to be taken care of so he has no pressures elsewhere, get his self-confidence back, which self-confidence should never be broken, he should never be distressed, allow him to retain his family the whole time, consider how he's being treated as a brother, and allow him to be that way. We don't want to put him in prison. Prison will kill the guy. Prison is going to make him worse than what he was before. Our idea of human rights is we take that guy that needs help and we help him. We make sure that he gets the help that he needs. It seems that it's not even a punishment. It's just a repayment because he owes the money. And now for him, we have to make him into a better person. See, crime and poverty. That's the way that we start off this parsha. Crime, as in the eved who needs to be sold and is punished, and poverty, where a guy sells his daughter. The two lowest elements of any society. Lowest elements, where crime and poverty are considered the least honorable. The least people in a society where they should bow to everybody else, nobody should bow to them. Those two people, factors which normally lower the respect that anybody gives to any human being, we place it at our head to show you that we show that respect. Respect to everyone. Everyone has dignity. Everyone has to be respected. That's Rav Hirsch's idea. And now that we see that, we can understand that in the short notes, we're giving the extremes to teach you the others. Meaning, if the Eved Ivri has to be treated with respect, and he gets the only pillow, and he is the only one that gets the food, etc., what does that mean about your friends? What does that mean about your wife? What does that mean about your kids? Who gets the only steak in the house? Is it you or your kids? If you're giving your only steak to the Eved Ivri, Kol Shekein, you should be giving your only steak to your kid. Do you hear it? It's such a brilliant idea. Give this case and it shows you human dignity that allows you to go the next way. Second case, if you go ahead and you say that an Amah Ivriya gets share Ksus V'Ona, all the requirements of a regular married woman, she'er is in food, ksus is in clothing. Oh no, we learn those three things, that the basic womanly rights that you get in marriage, we learn them from a shifcha, from the Amo Ivria. We learn it from this Amo Ivria. If she gets it, a woman who was sold into slavery by her father because he was so poor he couldn't do anything else. He's sold as a slave to a person that has to marry her, or to either himself or to his son. And that person, even she gets a regular ksufa. Well, certainly every woman deserves these rights as well. That's the culture thing. We're teaching you these things of human dignity to tell you if it's true by them, the lowest of society. Certainly it's true by the higher people in society.
Can she resist them? Can she say no, I don't want to do it?
if she's sold as a slave, then no, she is not allowed to, right? Because she's married off like anybody else marries off their daughter.
Well, it would be great for the
Catholic Court. Yeah, but that's so a story for another time.
He's selling somebody else's support as well. So they get Torah brothers as first.
Exactly. That's the concept, to show you that there is a Torah Shalpa out there. You have to understand that these laws were not the first. They already had tons of laws. They knew all of the laws. These are just the reminders and a telling tale. The only reason why it's there is to show you human dignity, and that's why you put it first, to be able to tell you everything else. It's the short notes to tell you everything. Isn't that brilliant? It's one of the best pieces from a verse I've heard from anyone that I've heard in a long time, because it's a total different way of looking at the Torah. I always thought, well, the Torah was the source, and the Torah Shalpeh stemmed from the Torah. It's not true. The Torah Shalpeh is the source, and the Torah Shabbat stemmed from the Torah Shabbat, so to speak. That's the idea behind it. It's such an unbelievable way of looking at it. We're going to stop. No, it makes sense. It's okay. No, it for sure makes sense. It's just a crazy line. There's so much more to say about it. We're going to stop with this right now.